This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, June 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party. He doesn't represent the values that the men and women who wear the uniform are fighting for. I've been in the Air Force for 33 years.
5 years ago, when Donald Trump announced his presidential campaign, he was met with derision by his Republican opponents, including Senator Lindsey Graham, heard there talking to CNN in 2015. Throughout the primaries, Trump was ridiculed for his lack of experience and excoriated for his inflammatory racial remarks. Trump's success in the primaries caused a rift in the party and the birth of the Never Trump movement, which sought to prevent him from securing the Republican nomination. But once Trump became president, even his most strident Republican critics became sycophantic supporters. Here's Lindsey Graham speaking at a Trump rally earlier this year.
Mr. President, thank you for being the best commander-in-chief since Ronald Reagan. Thank you for killing the terrorists over there so they can't hurt us over here. Thank you for sticking with Judge Kavanaugh. Mr. President, everybody in this room has one thing in common. We all have your back.
This seems to be changing as protests against police brutality and systemic racism in the United States continue here and abroad. Last week, Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke out against the president. And on Sunday, Mitt Romney marched in a Black Lives Matter protest in Washington. Former President George W. Bush has said he won't vote for Trump in November. And Trump's former Defense Secretary James Mattis called the president a threat to the Constitution. Susan Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me from Washington to discuss how Trump's response to the protests is affecting his relationship with his own party and his campaign for re-election. Susan, I'm so glad to have you back.
Dorothy, great to be with you. What a lot to discuss, huh?
We do. So we'll plunge right in. Who would have thought that a news story would emerge that would overshadow the global pandemic? So I just want to start by asking how political life in Washington is different suddenly. To what extent are things running as usual and what's changed?
Well, nothing is running as usual. I think that's fair to say. 3.5 years into the Trump presidency, we have sort of lurched from story to story, chaos to chaos, crisis to crisis. And of course, what's really remarkable about the last few months is just the scale and scope of the crises that we're facing, and the fact that many of them, for the first time, are not merely Trump initiated or Trump worsened, but genuine external crises that would have threatened and been a political challenge for any leader of the United States, a global public health crisis, economic catastrophe as a result of that, massive national outcry over police brutality and racial injustice. These rolling crises, of course, are also part of the rolling crisis that is the leadership crisis of the country under Donald Trump.
Some of it predating his administration, one must say.
Although, again, in all of those things, all of them exacerbated and worsened significantly and inflamed by the way in which the president has been handling them. And I think that is the through line that you're seeing. It's essentially a moment when the leadership of Donald Trump is being tested in a variety of extremely serious ways and obviously is having major political blowback for him.
Well, and not just Trump, but the Republican leadership. So we know the broad story of how Trump took over the Republican Party, but maybe you can help us go a little bit deeper. So maybe explain how Lindsey Graham goes from describing Trump as a xenophobic bigot to calling him the best president since Ronald Reagan. Is it just a matter of him running a tough reelection campaign for his seat in South Carolina, or what? Is there more to it than that?
If you're looking for the elected Republicans to lead here, don't look. They're followers, not leaders, and they're following what they believe to be Republican public opinion and the president here. And they've made that choice pretty firmly. You cited some very powerful counterexamples, but I think you know, again, where you're going to see the Republican pushback, where you're seeing resistance, is not primarily in the United States Senate, which at the moment is essentially a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump White House. Where you're largely seeing the resistance and the concern, it's in former officials like Jim Mattis. You're hearing it in the pushback of even currently serving U.S. Military officials who are very, very worried about being drawn into America's domestic political disputes. And you had this remarkable moment on Thursday when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, actually issued an apology for appearing in his combat fatigues alongside Donald Trump at that famous, or infamous, as the case may be, photo op in Lafayette Square. You know, will you see a bigger prison break when it comes to the Senate Republicans? I'm still skeptical, or, you know, to the extent you see them, it'll be with people like Lisa Murkowski or Mitt Romney, who are not up for reelection in 2020, or who come from states where there is more skepticism of Donald Trump. So, you know, it's a mixed picture, but in general, don't expect those elected Republican officials to lead anything at this point.
And that includes Susan Collins.
And that includes Susan Collins, the Maine senator who used to be the definition almost of moderate centrist Republicanism. She used to be very much supported and win re-election pretty easily by getting support of both Democrats and independents in Maine. That's no longer the case. Her polls dropped off a cliff when it came to those kind of voters with her support for Trump, and in particular with the polarizing events of the last couple years, the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, which she voted for, and the impeachment and trial of Donald Trump, in which she, in the end, voted to acquit Donald Trump. And so as a result of that, her only hope to win re-election, and it's increasingly a slim hope, is to get Republican voters to stick with her. And that is a good example, in a nutshell, of why these Republican senators have not been more courageous in standing up to Trump, even on what we used to think of as core matters of principle.
So, Susan, one of the dynamics here I find completely fascinating is the Never Trump movement and how it's reemerged in recent months. You've written about this. Maybe you could tell us what happened to the movement after Trump's election and what they're doing now. They seem to be back in full force.
Well, Dorothy, it's a very interesting story, right? Because it's a story both on the one hand of the failure in official Washington of the Never Trumpers. They lost the fight. The inside game is over, and Trump won that one. However, the outside game, the election game, that's the part that still is really a live action fight. It's not been resolved. And in fact, it all comes down to, in November in many ways, whether these Never Trump Republicans, alongside and acting in concert with Democrats and the Biden campaign, are able to peel off just enough Republicans or Republican-leaning independents who supported Trump 4 years ago. My friend Charlie Cook, who's a very respected nonpartisan analyst of elections, told me the other day he thinks it's about maybe 6 to 8% of the electorate that are Republicans or Republican-identifying independents who supported Trump, but they never liked him. They were never comfortable with him, but basically justified their vote, justified their continued support for him on the basis perhaps of the strong economy, and now are finding that that rationale has just utterly disappeared. If those people defect en masse, Donald Trump loses.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
at a time when Joe Biden seems to be keeping a pretty low profile, the Lincoln Project is doing an amazing job with its ad campaign against Trump. I mean, the scorching, it's quite remarkable.
Well, they really, you know, I've spoken at length with a number of the founders of that group, and including George Conway, by the way, who is the husband of Trump's White House counselor, Kellyanne Conway. So, of course, that's one of the main running psychodramas in Washington today. You know, and George said to me once, the goal was really to get inside Trump's head. You know, there was this one ad that they had a few weeks ago called Mourning in America, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G.
There's mourning in America. And under the leadership of Donald Trump, our country is weaker and sicker and poorer. And now, Americans are asking, if we have another 4 years like this, will there even be an America?
These folks literally paid only $5,000 to run that ad initially just on Fox News in Washington, D.C., so that Donald Trump would see it. And guess what? It worked and it drove him crazy. And he started tweeting about it in the middle of the night. And of course, calling much, much more attention both to the ad and to the Lincoln Project. So to me, that's sort of a metaphor for their entire campaign, which is really a way of taking the fight directly to Donald Trump in ways that, as you point out, Democrats have been somewhat hesitant to do, but these Republicans, you know, there's nothing like an apostate. Their internal war is playing out in a very scorched earth way.
And maybe you could bring us up to date on Sarah Longwell. You're quite young, Never Trumper, you profiled for the magazine earlier this year, who explicitly started this work because she thought Democrats weren't doing enough to attract wavering Republicans.
Well, that's right. And Sarah has worked alongside the Lincoln Project, but she set up her own group right now, which is running an interesting series of ads in which she has video testimonials from Republicans or former Republicans, Trump voters who say they will no longer vote for him. And when I, you know, got to know her over the course of the impeachment, you know, this was a running theme of her view of politics, which is the idea that you needed to give Republicans a permission structure to get them away from their party and their long-held beliefs. And that especially at this very tribalized, very partisan moment in American politics, almost as team sports, that even if you don't like your team captain, Donald Trump, you still identify so strongly with your own side that you have a very, very hard time actually pulling the trigger and voting against your own side. And so that's the niche of people that she's aiming at with these testimonials. And I think it's likely to be quite effective. The issue, of course, is whether it's enough to be politically decisive in any of these battleground states. There are some people who think it's a very smart move. On the other hand, there are people whose theory of politics, and this includes the Trump campaign, is that politics today is all about getting your own passionate supporters to come out and vote, in which case you would think that Democrats should not spend a lot of time trying to get Republican votes like Sarah is trying to recruit, but should spend their time rather making sure of the support of the left flank that supported Bernie Sanders, making sure that African-American voters who staunchly support Democrats are both enthusiastic about Joe Biden and whoever he picks as a running mate, but also that they're able to vote.
So far, Trump isn't budging from his law and order talking points, but he has also been, as we know, consistently critical of officials in his own Justice Department. Just a month or so ago, he argued that the department's case against his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, had been led by dirty, filthy cops at the top of the FBI.
You know, Dorothy, I'm so glad you pointed that out. Donald Trump seems to think that the cops are always right and that, the police are always the good guys, except when it comes to investigating him or his friends. He has actually used the phrase dirty cops. I looked this up several dozen times in the last few months. You know, law and order is Donald Trump's new campaign slogan, except that it seems like it, in his view, it applies to everybody except for himself.
After the polling in 2016 turned out to be less than accurate, I've become even more wary about what to make of current polls at any one moment. However, it's worth pointing out that we're now seeing broad support for Black Lives Matter, and a new poll from Monmouth University, which found that 76% of Americans consider racism and discrimination to be a big problem. That's a 26-point difference from 2015. Can this momentum sustain itself?
Well, so, you know, there's two interesting and related sort of polling developments right now. One, Trump and his own kind of sagging in the polls as a result of these converging different leadership crises. Broadly speaking, the polls in 2016 were accurate at the national level, but very inaccurate or insufficient in key states such as Pennsylvania and Michigan. So no one's really going to believe, you know, that they know the outcome, no matter how wide the gap is, until, you know, the election is done and over with. As to the issue of policy issues, you are seeing, I think, a remarkable shift in public opinion, regardless of what the actual number is. It seems quite clear that there's been just a decisive national turn in a way that is rarely recorded in the annals of polling history. What that translates into in terms of actual policy changes, I would remind you that there was an overwhelming national consensus on certain gun control measures, such as banning assault rifles. You would have thought for sure that that overwhelming national consensus would result in new gun control measures. And of course, it did not end in that way. And so I just would caution as far as how much meaningful or lasting change is likely to happen right away as a result of what looks like a remarkable new political consensus in the United States.
I have to let you go in a moment to write your column. But in the meantime, I just have one more question, which is what you make of Joe Biden's current strategy.
Well, look, I mean, certainly there's a pretty hard and fast rule in politics, as in life, that if your opponent is shooting himself in the foot, you know, please get out of the way and let him do so. And more or less, that has happened, and that has led to Biden widening his lead in the polls. You know, if you talk to people who monitor the electorate very closely, you know, they are of the absolute belief that if this is an election that is largely a referendum on the incumbent, as U.S. presidential elections that feature an incumbent almost always are, that Donald Trump will lose. So they see Trump's pretty singular goal and also necessity in the next few months as somehow finding a way to drive up Joe Biden's unfavorability ratings. You know, that their view is that people are not really going to change their mind about Donald Trump at this point, but maybe they would change their mind about Joe Biden. And so to that extent, you know, Joe Biden, he has this dilemma of needing to reappear in public, but at the same time, the more he does so, the more risk he's at, of course, of doing something that would change the dynamics of a race that are right now very much in his favor. So, you know, they're going to be very cautious and understandably about putting him out there much more, no matter how much the pundits clamor for Joe Biden to get out of his basement. My guess is that his strategists are delighted to have him stuck in the basement.
Well, thanks so much, Susan. I will let you go and hope you come back soon.
Dorothy, it's so great to be with you.
Susan B. Glasser, a staff writer at The New Yorker, writes a weekly column on Trump's Washington and is the co-author of Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.